Why is the essay more popular than ever? Philip Lopate is here to discuss Charles D'Ambrosio's new collection in the State of the Essay.
He really is a skeptic. He really is somebody who is continually thinking against himself and questioning himself.
And what can the history of cotton tell us about capitalism? Sven Beckerts joins us to talk about his new book.
Once you start looking at the history of cotton, once you start looking at this history of capitalism, you just notice that violence plays a very large role.
We also have Alexandra Alter on publishing news and Greg Coles with bestsellers. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review, and I'm Beryl Sagal. This is Beryl Sagal, an editor at the New York Times Book Review, and today we're talking about the art of the essay. And we're so lucky to have with us Philip Lopate, one of the most remarkable essayists we have, author of the books Portrait Inside My Head and To Show and To Tell, The Craft of Literary Nonfiction. In this week's issue, he reviews Charles D'Ambrosio's new essay collection, the wonderfully titled Loitering. Welcome, Philip.
Glad to be here.
So, Philip, you have high praise for D'Ambrosio, and you say he's one of the strongest, smartest, and most literate essayists practicing today, and he's got a cult reputation. I don't think many of our readers will have heard of him. Tell me a little bit about him. Who is he?
Well, he's written some short story collections, but he's really best known among those who follow that kind of thing as a powerful essayist, mm-hmm. somebody who writes essays that you're not going to forget. When I was asked to review the book, I thought there were lots of pretenders, people who don't quite make it, but I thought that D'Ambrosio is the real deal. Mm-hmm. So I did not want to hold back on my praise. I wanted to say, look, everybody, you know, this is somebody who really understands the form and was able to practice it at the top of his talents.
Yeah, and as you say, this is his moment. This should be his moment.
This is his moment. Yes, I was trying to crown him, but who knows? Who knows if it will have any effect? You know?
Well, tell us a little bit more about the persona we encounter in the essays. I think his fiction, he's been sort of lumped together with Raymond Carver's writing a certain, like a certain kind of dirtily realist fiction,
you know,
about fathers and sons and a lot of working class issues. Is that the same man that we encounter in these essays?
Yes and no. I mean, he presents himself as somebody who comes from the West and very smartly says it's a kind of a provincialism and reverse snobism attached to the Western He-Man kind of
the
thing.
Swagger.
You know? Yes, the swagger. But he is extremely educated and extremely bookish. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, you have this kind of guy who likes to hop freight trains and sleep in mine shafts when things are going bad. And on the other hand, somebody who can drop any number of cultural references, you know, and he really is learned. Mm-hmm. You know, he really is somebody who you want to be in his company. It's a very cultivated company.
He wears it lightly almost, too. And the interesting thing is, when I was reading his essays, as you say, it's spliced full of quotations. It almost reminds you of Montaigne a little bit.
Exactly.
You know, he'll veer off and suddenly remember this thing Seneca said. And does he have antecedents? Does he remind you of somebody, his tone or his approach?
Well, he himself claims he's read Didion and Baldwin and all the people you would expect, plus, of course, Montaigne and Hazlitt. He's got a little bit of a beat aspect to him.
That's good,
But he really is a skeptic. He really is somebody who is continually thinking against himself and questioning himself. And one of the things that I think is most remarkable about D'Ambrosio is that he foregrounds his own confusion and ignorance. At the same time, you feel that he's always in control. Mm. He's always, his sentences are the opposite of confused. Mm-hmm. He claims he wants to track the confusions of his mind or the motions of his mind. And so, on the one hand, he is very much in the Montaigne tradition of somebody who's just following out his thoughts. On the other hand, you never really feel that he's losing the shape of the essay. Mm. It's still very tightly controlled, and I think partly he does that by keeping the tension high. Mm. And he keeps the tension high in a lot of ways, even though he claims that he's not really asserting any strong point of view. He presents an I character, the D'Ambrosio character, who's really an extremist, somebody who is about to crack up, somebody who sees himself as an outsider, maybe one step away from the hobo looking in the window at your dining experience. So he does that thing that, you know, Thomas Bernhardt does, for instance, you know, of making himself out to be, you know, a few steps away from the madhouse. Yeah. And at the same time, he's extremely reasonable because he's got a good mind and he thinks very hard. And so what he's really doing that I admire so much and that I like to do in my own essays is he's saying, what do I really think about this? Not what does my peer group say I should think about this? What is a politically correct thing to think about this? You know, he thinks, well, you know, what's wrong with this? Why am I getting the heebie-jeebies when I think about Save the Whales people or something like that, you know?
No, actually, that's a really good point. And I think in that way, he does remind me of your essays where the drama is essentially a mind interrogating itself.
Thank you.
I mean, let's talk a little bit about what some of these essays are about.
Yes.
And there's some very, very sort of dark topics that he investigates, right? There's suicide, there are family legacies of madness.
Yes, and solitude, isolation, loneliness, whatever you want to call it. He does something that a lot of essayists in the past have done, which is he presents himself as a kind of a oddball and isolate, you know? And I think that in a strange way that helps generate a kind of authority on the page for the essayist. He's not saying, I'm an expert. He's saying, I am one, I am singular. So listen to me because you may be singular too in an odd way. It's not exactly antisocial, but there is something forlorn in his temperament. And of course, you know, he had a crazy father. Mm. He had one brother who committed suicide. He had another brother who jumped off the bridge in Seattle. His bona fides of family suffering are quite real.
Yeah. But there's also something about the man, and I think you make this point really, really well in the essay, sort of acknowledging both how he does that, like Thomas Bernhard, you know, man on the edge, man about to be,
ranting,
you know,
yes.
Right, institutionalized.
Right.
But he's also, you know, a prize-winning writer.
Exactly.
You know, he teaches at some of the finest institutions in America. And,
exactly.
And not to say one can't be both.
He doesn't want to play that card too obviously.
Yeah.
He wants to look at places where there's a lot of contradiction and uncertainty. So, for instance, he has an essay about this teacher, Letourneau, who had an affair with her high school student. He talks about how everybody, all these experts, these psychologists, jumped on the bandwagon to say, naughty, naughty, this is terrible.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he says, you know, she thought she was in love.
Yeah.
Beyond the ethical question of a teacher sleeping with a student, you know, she thought it was the real thing,
mm-hmm.
love.
Mm-hmm.
Part of what D'Ambrosio is doing, he's trying to wrest control away from the experts
mm-hmm.
who, you know, are very quick to make a judgment
mm-hmm.
and to speak for all those who are uncertain, mm-hmm. who aren't sure what they think politically or on issues like this, and to look at it from many different sides and to complicate. And that's really his mission, I think, to move you off of the smugness of certainty,
mm-hmm.
to move you off of your self-righteousness, to place you in a dangerous place.
I mean, I don't know how much of his fiction you've read, but I think it's always been interesting to me. The transition between writing fiction
right.
and writing essays seems
right.
to be so difficult for writers to do. I'm trying to come up with writers who can do it. Virginia Woolf.
Exactly.
And then I draw a blank. Is it two different, you know, sets of skills that are just completely at odds together? Is it a different kind of sensibility?
They
can
are.
Flourish in one?
In the United States, there have been a number of writers who wanted to think of themselves as fiction writers and were actually better as nonfiction writers.
Sontag.
So we think of Susan Sontag, who really didn't have much of an ability to write. We think of Didion. We think of James Baldwin.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
To some extent, Norman Mailer, mm-hmm. Gore Vidal. You know, there were lots of them because in some ways fiction has always had greater status. Listen, I've done it myself. I've written fiction and I've written nonfiction. And the way that I resolve it is that I write for every 10 years of nonfiction, I write 1 year of fiction. but it is a very different sensibility. I mean, if you look at Sontag, for instance, she was very, very good at knowing what she thought and felt and not so good at empathizing with
mm-hmm.
others. She could assert a very strong persona in her essays, but when it came to fiction, she couldn't imagine herself into other people.
Yeah, and so they didn't want to, maybe.
Yes, exactly. They were far inferior to her.
Yeah. so perhaps we can pan out a little bit and talk more about the essay today. In certain ways, it feels like the essay is a dominant form.
You know,
it's the thing that students, and I'm sure you know, you teach at Columbia, and it's the form that, you know, young writers come to first, the personal essay. Is there a mode of essay you're seeing? Is there a new essay? Is there a sort of something that's in fashion today?
Certainly there are fashions in essay writing today, and I think that this is a good moment for the essay right now. We've had a lot of collections just in the last year or year and a half that have been very striking, like Megan Daum's book, The Unspeakable, Leslie Jameson's The Empathy Exams. Laura Kipnis has a new collection, Men. I could add my own books to that. So this has been a good period. Emily Fox Gordon had a wonderful book, Book of Days. And this is after a period when we were told that that essays were publishing death, that nobody wanted to put them out. And suddenly we've had a lot of essay collections coming out. In the past, you had essay collections by best-selling authors like John Updike or Simon Sharma, who weren't principally essayists, and this was a kind of favor done to them to keep them in the house. But now you have a lot of collections, and it feels like a form that is good at delivering vulnerability, intimacy. D'Ambrosio talks about the conversational element, the fact that for him, the essayists he loved were brothers and sisters, not parents, you know. So there is a kind of connection that is very quickly able to be established. I think in your question, you know, some of the fashions, certainly the lyric essay is one. We see that in Marilyn Nelson's work. If you look at Leslie Jameson's collection, it really is a hybrid between journalism and the personal essay, because she did a lot of these pieces on assignment, just as Charles D'Ambrosio did some of them on assignment. And this is just a very practical thing. Then the essayist has to try to conjure up some theme, some pretend theme that will say, well, this is really much more connected than it looks. It's not a random collection of essays.
This is not how I made my living in 2013.
Right. You know,
what brings me to loitering? What connects these essays? I mean, the title is wonderful.
He is trying to suggest in the title that the essay itself as a form is a rambling, stopping, starting, circling form where you hang in there, you're not really sure where you're going.
Yeah.
Loitering with intent, of course. So you have an intent, which is to get somewhere, but you don't start out knowing where you're going to go. So this is the essay as exploration, or as its original French meaning was, an attempt. It implies a certain modesty, just as loitering implies, you know, well, this is not somebody who is a player.
Yeah.
This is not somebody who is one of the captains of industry. You know, this is somebody who, you know, we might have to say, move along now.
There's also something wonderfully disingenuous about it, too.
Yeah.
You know, because he's loitering, but with pen and paper in hand.
Exactly.
Okay, thank you so much, Philip.
My pleasure.
Again, the book is Loitering, New and Collected Essays by Charles D'Ambrosio. We're joined now by Alexandra Alter with Publishing News. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pearl.
So I hear you have a bit of a books preview for 2015.
I do. Since this is our first podcast of 2015, I thought I would mention a few of the books that people in the industry are most excited about. There's a bunch of great fiction and nonfiction coming this year. It's looking like it's going to even rival 2014. Mm-hmm. Starting in January, one of the books that I loved that I think a lot of people will be interested in is The First Bad Man. It's Miranda July's first novel. People know her more as a filmmaker and a performance artist. She's written short fiction, too,
right,
in The New Yorker. But this is her first novel, and it happened at an interesting time for her. She just had her first child, and the novel sort of touches on those issues. It's a very sort of in her usual sort of
quirky
style, but it deals with very serious emotions as well, very sympathetic characters and strange characters.
I'm sure.
Yeah, and that's coming in January. And later in the spring, I'm extremely excited for The Buried Giant, which is Ishiguro's first novel in about a decade since Never Let Me Go. Yeah.
There were stories, Nocturnes.
He's had short stories, but not a big novel. And so people are extremely excited about this.
And what do we know? Is there a sci-fi?
Yes, it's not sci-fi. It's vaguely fantasy.
Okay.
takes place sort of in ancient England in sort of the Iron Age. There's Saxons, there's knights, there's magic. It's not what you would particularly expect from him, but it deals with all of the same themes that he's always wrestling with, of, you know, memory and how it can betray us and sort of people's inability to know their own feelings and their own selves and their spouses. And so it's a very interesting book. And
he's completely unpredictable. I feel like every book he's done has been different.
Exactly. So this is another one that I think is going to really test people's perceptions of him and maybe reshape his literary legacy in a way. Mm-hmm. And the summer is going to be massive as well. Another author that we haven't seen something from in a while, Judy Blume. She has her first adult novel in 16 years. It's called In the Unlikely Event, and it's set in New Jersey in the early 50s, and it's about a series of plane crashes which actually happened, and she lived through those and was traumatized by them. So,
and Jersey sort of, in the 50s, that's her era.
Exactly, right? Exactly. So, but and it's for adults. I think that should be fun. And also in the spring, Toni Morrison has a new novel, God Help the Child, which people are very excited about. Mm-hmm.
Is it a big novel? I think her last one was quite slender, no?
Yes, Mercy. That's right,
really
it was.
Sort of like a short, compact story.
Right.
So is this like a more of a sprawling story? Do we know much about it yet?
What I've read about it is that it sort of tackles the aftermath of a student's allegations against a teacher. Mm. And I'm not so sure about the scope, but it sounds like the subject matter will be somewhat explosive. Mm-hmm. Another summer title that I think people will be really excited about is Kate Atkinson's next novel. Did you like Life After Life?
I loved Life After Life. And I love her, like her crime novels are great too.
Her crime novels are incredible. Did you like Teddy, the character in Life After Life?
So
perhaps you know this already, but A God in Gruins, her next novel is about Teddy.
Oh, great.
And what happens to him. Just started it. It's excellent. I don't think it has the same sort of structural conceit as Life After Life, but it certainly takes place in that world, and you'll see many of the same characters and the same sort of tone and some of the same issues.
Yeah.
And then, of course, fall, Jonathan Franzen's next novel, Purity.
And do we know anything about that?
We do. It is sort of, again, a multi-generational epic, but it tackles some contemporary issues. The lead character's name is Purity, and she sort of has this, it sounds like she travels around the world, is trying to find out who her father is. Mm-hmm. There's some roots in East Germany, and she has some kind of involvement with a charismatic hacker type.
And possibly some birds.
Let's hope for some birds. There's always a bird or two in a Jonathan Franzen novel. And then on the nonfiction side, Patti Smith has her second memoir coming out, follow-up to her bestseller, Just Kids, in September. Fantastic. So that'll be fun. Aziz Ansari has his first book coming out about dating in the modern era. It's called Modern Romance. And, of course, with, you know, huge smashes from everyone from Tina Fey to Amy Poehler to Mindy Kaling to Lena Dunham. He's the latest sort of actor to jump into the publishing world. And we'll see how well his comedy translates. And two other big nonfiction titles. Stacey Schiff has a book coming out on the Salem witch trials, which sounds fantastic. Yeah. Her last book was Cleopatra. Yeah. And John Meacham has a book on George W. Bush.
So much to look forward to.
There is.
Thank you so much, Alexandra.
Thanks for having me.
The Harvard historian Sven Beckert has written one of the year's most provocative books, Empire of Cotton, which argues that it was the industrialization of one commodity, cotton, that spurred the invention of modern capitalism. Empire of Cotton was reviewed for us by Adam Hochschild, who called it a major work of scholarship and praised the book's rigor and compassion. And Sven Beckert is joining us over the phone from Boston. Welcome, Sven.
Thank you.
So the first question I suspect some listeners and readers might have is, why cotton? Why was cotton the engine of change and not, say, sugar or indigo or even tobacco, so many other commodities that seem to link the world?
This is obviously a very important question that goes to the very core of what Empire of Cotton is about. My choice to focus on cotton was not so much driven by that this is a fascinating history about which we can learn a lot, but it was very much driven by my wanting to understand the long history of global capitalism and with it the origins of the world in which we live today. So cotton is particularly suited for such an analysis because the growing and manufacturing of cotton was the most important industry that humans engaged in already approximately in the past 1,000 years, though well before the Industrial Revolution. By the late 18th century, it was at the very core of the Industrial Revolution, which is one of the most important events in human history, and thus looking at Cotton helps us explain why the Industrial Revolution happened at this particular moment in time and why it happened in this particular place. And then Cotton remained very, very important, even central to the history of capitalism throughout the 19th century and into the 20th century. And so in some ways, looking at the commodity of cotton allows us to understand the origins of modern capitalism. It allows us to understand the global inequalities that capitalism has brought about. It allows us to understand the enormous productivity advances that capitalism has brought about. And it gives a kind of empirical core. It allows me to tell the history of capitalism not so much as an abstract history, as a history of a concept, but it allows me to tell what I call a history of capitalism in action.
Now, it's said that cotton might be one of our most studied industries, commodities even, right? Like there are thousands of studies and books about, you know, cotton in India, cotton in Brazil. But your book is unique in sort of taking a global perspective. Can you tell us a little bit about what you found, what this helped you do?
Much of history, as it has been written over the past 100 or 150 years, has always focused on particular regions, on particular cities, or on particular nations, such as the history of the United States, French history, Brazilian history, and so on. So this book, Empire of Cotton, takes a fundamentally different perspective. The book takes you into the history of 19th century Indian industrialization. You encounter African merchants, planters in the American South, child workers in Great Britain, graduates of the Tuskegee Institute working in the German colony of Togo. You encounter Central Asian peasants, so a whole range of actors. But it's not so much to be comprehensive, to kind of list everything that happened in regard to cotton, but much more fundamentally, the argument is that this history can only be understood from a global perspective, and capitalism can only be understood from such a global perspective.
Right. Well, let's look at some of the fallacies about capitalism that your book unpacks and exposes. And our review singled out that one of the book's greatest contributions is showing how every stage of the industrialization of cotton depended on violence, coercion, exploitation. Can you tell us a little bit about the human cost?
When we talk about the history of capitalism, if we talk about the history of industrialization, we like to talk about markets, the expansion of markets. We like to talk about contracts. We like to talk about the rule of law, the emergence and spread of wage labor. And most importantly, we are very attached to the notion that the expansion of capitalism brought about an expansion of human freedoms. There is considerable truth in that story. But when you look at the history of cotton, and thus the history of capitalism, you also see, as you mentioned, that that violence plays an enormously important role within that history. And that violence took very many different forms in different regions of the world in different times. So, for example, when it comes to securing of vastly increased quantities of raw cotton, you see that the expansion of industrialization went along mm-hmm. with the expansion of slavery in the Caribbean, in South America, and then when it comes to cotton, especially in the southern parts of the United States. So there is an enormous degree of violence in the mobilization of labor in agriculture production. That kind of violence that is embedded within plantation slavery, that comes to an end, as far as the Empire of Cotton is concerned, comes to an end in 1865 with the emancipation of enslaved people in the United States. But coercion and violence continues. It continues in particular in the global countryside, and it continues to this very day when, for example, in the nation of Uzbekistan to this day, children are forced to engage in cotton harvest. Violence is also present to a surprising degree in industrialization itself. If you look at the people who ended up working in the first cotton mills, a very, very large number of them and a very high percentage of the total workforce were children who didn't have much of a choice but to work in cotton mills. If you look at some parts of the world, such as late 19th and early 20th century Japan, there is a significant degree of coercion in mobilizing women workers for cotton factories. So once you start looking at the history of cotton, and once you start looking at this history of capitalism, you just notice that violence plays a very, very large role in this history of capitalism. And of course, this is somewhat disconcerting, because we are often, for good reasons, we are very invested in telling a different story about capitalism, which, again, is not completely wrong, that story, but we have to acknowledge that this story also goes along with another story, and that is the story that Empire of Cotton tells.
Can we go back to the early days, just to give a sense of how cotton, where did it come from? How was it produced? Because I think some of this will be genuinely new to some readers, that it was a humble household crop, wasn't it?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. We associate cotton very much with kind of modern industry. And what few people know is that that the production of cotton textiles has a very, very long history. And the book charts some of that history in its first chapter. As far as we know, humans have produced cotton textiles for at least 5,000 years. During most of these millennia, cotton was grown by small farmers in small quantities, and it was grown alongside their food crops. They harvested that cotton, and then they spun it in their huts and eventually wove it into fabrics. So most of the cotton that was produced in the world for the first 5,000 years of the history of the cotton industry was produced within households and then manufactured within households and also consumed within households. Mm-hmm. There were three early centers of this industry. One was South Asia, the other one was East Africa, and the third one was Central America. And from these parts of the world, it spread into other areas of the world. So from South Asia, for example, it spread into what is now Indonesia and what is now Japan and China to the east, but then also it spread to the west into all the way into what is now Iraq and Anatolia, Turkey, and such places. Cotton agriculture spread to such a degree that I'm arguing that by the year 1000 of the Common Era, the cotton industry was probably the most significant manufacturing activity that humans engaged in. And it had become very important in very many different parts of the world. And at this point, there was also already some long-distance trade in cotton textiles. So not all of the textiles produced in households were used within these households, but partly now they were also traded, and partly they were traded over very long distances. And this is how Europeans, for the first time, came into contact with cotton fabrics.
They Which brings us to the puzzle of the book, right? Which is just how did European societies who had nothing to do with cotton come to so thoroughly dominate the industry? And you have a phrase in your book that I was wondering if you could tell us about, and you call it war capitalism. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So the real puzzle is that this industry is the most important industry in the world. It is focused on, as I mentioned, on South Asia, on Eastern Africa and Central America, and Europe is completely marginal to it. I mean, there's some cotton imports into Europe, but otherwise Europe does not play much of a role in that industry. And it continues to not play much of a role in that industry until the 17th and into the 18th century, but eventually it comes to dominate this industry. This industry becomes completely centered on the continent of Europe by the 19th century. And this is, I think, one of the greatest questions we can ask about modern history, of how come that Europe came and Europeans came to play such an important role within an industry to which they had been so marginal for so many centuries or even millennia. And the answer that I find to that question is slightly different from the answer that we traditionally have found, which have very much focused on, you know, Europeans' ability to invent new machines in the late 18th century to make the production of cotton much more productive. There was something that came prior to the technical innovations of the Industrial Revolution. What came prior was that Europeans had, since the 16th century, had increasingly dominated the global networks of the cotton industry. They had increasingly dominated the global trade in cotton textiles, especially connecting South Asia to Africa and to the Americas and to Europe. They had come to increasingly capture territories on which cotton could be grown for European industry, mostly in the Americas, the expropriation of territories in the Americas. And they also had captured workers, enslaved Africans, who would do the labor of the growing of cotton. So, and this moment in the history of capitalism, which really comes prior to the Industrial Revolution, that moment I'm calling war capitalism. And
right,
the war capitalism is a kind of combination of colonial expansion, the expropriation of the lands of native peoples,
the engagement in armed trade and the institution of slavery.
Right, and this was an era that, like, I think, you know, generally in school, you know, we're taught a much more benign term, right? We're taught mercantile capitalism is generally the name of this. So in calling it war capitalism, what kind of meanings are you trying to seed into this era in these sort of activities?
Yes, you're exactly right. I think we have called this mercantile capitalism, merchant capitalism, and other such names. The word war in war capitalism is not meant to emphasize the importance of war between states, even though that also played a role, but this is not what it really is about. It's meant to emphasize the violence of the process that we can observe.
Let's move on to the present day a little bit. And I think, you know, you made the point about how many children are involved in cotton production in Uzbekistan. And, you know, and I think that listeners will probably also remember the collapse of the Rana Plaza factories in Bangladesh. Are we still in an era where cotton is king?
Cotton is astonishingly important to the world today. It's not that important anymore to the United States. Obviously, for the American economy as a whole, cotton is not particularly important today. But for the global economy, it is still significant. There are estimates that to this day, 350 million people in the world are engaged in the growing of cotton, the spinning and weaving of cotton, and then the manufacturing of cotton textiles, which is a very, very large number, and indeed more than were ever engaged in these activities ever before in human history. If you want to understand the shape of global capitalism today, I think you're not that well served by focusing exclusively on cotton. I think you would miss a lot of very, very significant developments. But it also then depends what parts of the world you're looking at.
Right.
If you look, as you mentioned, at Bangladesh, then the textile industry is certainly extremely important. If you look at China, the spinning and weaving of cotton and also the growing of cotton is still a very, very significant industry. There are still many millions of people in the world who are engaged in this industry.
Yeah, and you make a really beautiful point in your book, just sort of explaining how reliant we are on cotton.
Right.
You know, without cotton, we would live in a monochromatic world of woolens. So this idea that we take it for granted, and we also have taken so many aspects of its history for granted,
right,
and so many aspects of its production for granted. Thank you so much for joining me, Sven. Again, the book is Empire of Cotton, reviewed in this week's New York Times Book Review by Adam Hochschild.
Thank you so much for having me.
Joined now by Greg Coles with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Parle.
What's going on?
For the second week in a row, the answer to that question is nothing. There are literally no new titles on the hardcover fiction or nonfiction list. But I do have to write a column every week. So I looked at Stephen Brill, whose new book is going to be on the cover of our January 11th issue. His new book, America's Bitter Pill, does not come out in time to make this list, but he does have a history on the bestseller list.
He does.
Yeah, his very first book back in 1978, he wrote a book called The Teamsters, and it hit the hardcover nonfiction list in 1978. The book review back then called it The Whole Squalid Story Meticulously Researched. And then in 2011, he also spent a few weeks on the extended list with a book that he did about America's educational system called Class Warfare.
Okay, what do we know about this new book?
This new book is about the healthcare system, America's Bitter Pill. He really...
So again, a squalid story meticulously told.
Yeah, he's quite an extensive researcher and reporter. He really kind of gets in the trenches and talks to everybody. Mm-hmm. He goes in kind of explicitly, intentionally knowing nothing and just tries to absorb the entire story. So he talks to people throughout, very involved in public policy.
Okay.
And so as it happens, this book tells the story of the coming together of the Affordable Care Act and opposition to it and what it's like for people to be underinsured. And so it's, you know, a very in-depth look at the healthcare system.
Mm-hmm.
He really looks a lot at hospitals and kind of healthcare expenses, mm-hmm. where the what's driving most of the expenses. That's what this book is.
Okay.
I do also mention that he, of course, has a very legal background. He's a graduate of Yale Law School, and he founded the American Lawyer magazine in 1979. He also founded Court TV. So the book review back in 2008 asked him to review a John Grisham thriller. for us, which really made a lot of sense. Yeah. And he did a great job on it. His review appeared on the cover. He liked the politics of the book. He didn't much care for the writing. He called it Grisham style. He said his weakness with words is painful to watch, as if someone new to English decided to mimic the bonfire of the vanities.
God, that's damning. That's damning.
I also looked this week in my column back 30 years ago to the bestseller list, which is kind of the cop-out that I do when there's nothing new to write about on the list. I haven't done it in a couple of years, and so it was interesting for me now to go back and look three decades ago. The most interesting thing was how similar the nonfiction list was 30
really?
Years ago. Yeah. You know, you think, oh, it's the height of the go-go
right.
1980s,
right.
and almost book for book, you can go through and find correspondences.
Wow, wow.
Like the Leo Biscaglia book, Loving Each Other, uh-huh. was number two on that list. It's kind of inspirational musings, just the way that Anne Lamott's new book, Small Victories, is, which is on this week's
so list.
So
our appetites are fairly consistent
really
when it comes to
consistent.
Nonfiction.
Really consistent. You have Andy Rooney, Pieces of My Mind,
yeah,
his essays,
yeah.
which I'm tempted to match Andy Rooney to Andy Cohen with the Andy Cohen Diaries. But in fact, it's probably a closer match to Charles Krauthammer's Things That Matter, which is also a TV commentator's essays, kind of philosophical
essays. Do you think it's more that, you know, when it comes to this time of year and gift giving, you know, we just want to, we have a certain idea of what kinds of books people want to receive and messages that we're trying to send with books?
I don't know if it's the time of year. I mean, because these are categories that are pretty consistently
right.
on the list.
Right.
I think it's just that although eras change,
yeah.
our reading interests really don't. The
yeah.
one thing that I had a hard time finding any kind of match for, and it is emblematic of the go-go 1980s. The number one book 30 years ago on the January 13th, 1985 list was the autobiography of Lee Iacocca. So yeah, it's
wow.
Iacocca
yeah.
and autobiography, the big corporate titan.
Yeah.
And I think you'd have a hard time these days finding kind of the big business executive as a hero.
That's
the,
right.
the way that Iacocca
well, but
book
mean, now
was.
I think it's shifted to biographies, right? Now you have the Isaacson biographies,
of
Jobs
course,
and everything.
Right.
So now
there,
it's a little
there
bit
you
more
go.
Covert.
And that Isaacson yeah. The Isaacson's The Innovators
right.
is again on the list,
right.
and it is a business book. So
right.
you're right. There is a There's
some consistency
very good
there. Problem. Well, you know, I actually have read the Lee Iacocca memoir. I'm sorry to say, yeah, yeah.
You must have been about 8 years old when that
I was
came
about
out.
Nine
that was
ten.
Your bedtime reading?
Yeah, and I think that my criticisms of his prose style, I think Stephen Brill would have some things to say about that.
Iacocca style.
Thanks so much, Greg.
Thanks, Pearl.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.